Uproar in the Studio, your bi-weekly New York-based Chinese blockbuster podcast. I'm Noah.
I'm Reza.
I'm Andrew.
This week we're talking about Operation Red Sea, released on February 23rd, 2018. It made more than $570 million. You don't have to see it, we'll give a synopsis, but if you want to watch it unspoiled, maybe listen to the show after.
Later, we speak with Professor James Dorsey, senior fellow at Singapore's Rajaratnam School of International Studies, as well as Middle East Institute. He is a writer of the blog, Middle East Soccer, and author of most recently, China and the Middle East, Venturing into the Maelstrom.
But before that, we're talking about the movie. Here's our conversation.
When the Republic of Iwe's military fails to suppress the violent terrorist faction Zaka, an elite squad is sent from the Chinese Navy to escort all Chinese citizens out of the country. As cities devolve into war zones, the escort mission becomes a hostage rescue. Along the way, the squad joins forces with an investigative journalist with information on a secret arms deal with potentially dire consequences. In the end, the squad is able to free all the held hostages and prevent the arms deal, going above and beyond the call of duty but sustaining heavy losses throughout. Combat, combat, candy, and more combat. This is Operation Red Sea.
What do we think of the movie?
So I'm not really big into war movies in general, but I mean, it's not really my style, honestly.
Dude, this is the PLA preventing war. It's
right. It's an anti-war movie.
This is anti-war. It's super gruesome, though.
Yeah, it does not feel like it's a pro-war movie in any stretch of the word.
And yet, it has, like, images, especially towards the beginning, where they're, like, on their aircraft carrier, sort of running in slow motion, all lined up. It just looks so much like a car commercial or something for a military.
Yeah, it went really far into the naming everybody and saying their roles too.
Right.
Like that lasted really far into the movie.
But I like
that was shot like Power Rangers.
And that was their only like characterization essentially.
Yeah, except that one guy liked candy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
One guy liked candy, and one of them was a woman, and that was her character.
Right.
Nah, she was good, dude. That was so progressive. The U.S. would never escape.
They literally labeled her female gunner, and that was all she was.
I mean, that may be an aspect of, like, the translation being, like, we're indicating that this is a gendered noun.
I mean, yeah, maybe.
Maybe. But also, I don't know.
What do you think was literal documentary?
I don't think that it was literal documentary.
Dude, well, I'm pretty sure this was all real footage of the real story of evacuating Chinese citizens out of Yemen.
I mean, the special effects team on this was really pulling their weight.
They took a guy's face off.
Yeah.
So awesome.
And just all of the on-site explosions, like that, like, it didn't feel like there were so many visual effects. It felt like it was mostly on-set special effects. Yeah. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, no, it's what was interesting about this movie, though, was that it had all of the aesthetics of a modern action movie. Like, it could have been a Dunkirk, it could have been a Dark Knight, it could have been a Bourne movie, but none of the, like, sense of plot or pacing, or not even sense of plot, none of the plot, no plot.
Dude, there was plot. They're saving citizens and preventing terrorists from acquiring nuclear material. That's pretty noble.
Episodic mission-based, like watching the first one, our friend Pranav was saying, this is like Call of Duty levels, but you can't control anything.
Yeah, some of them were even shot in that first
This movie was extremely Call of Duty.
I mean, I'm just going to compare this to, I guess, The Hurt Locker, because I've talked with some military veterans about that movie, and they've told me that that's very realistic in terms of what it's like to serve and, like, downtime versus conflict. In this movie, there's absolutely no downtime at all.
Dude, you're in the middle of a war zone for, like, the entirety of the film.
Seriously, but I feel like that would have been a necessary aspect because of this, you don't know any of the characters.
The antagonists are like super, super obscure too, and I like you know
they're just wearing like monkey masks essentially.
Well there's like skull ISIS like masks. Jihadis, right? Like the Zaka.
And then they're mercenaries, yeah.
They're mercenaries, but then there's also like Shia extremism, right? Like the leader of the rebel
is a very Ayatollah
Sayyid,
like,
then he's wearing like a black turban or something. Like that was extremely strange, but I don't know. I guess they're trying to show the Yemeni civil war, which just has way too many actors. So, I don't know. Good.
A preface to a conversation. One thing we didn't talk about in the interview was, like, China and Yemen with that fucking port.
Yeah.
So what China and Yemen actually does is, like, kind of messed up on a... Like, it's one of the most messed up examples of a Belt and Road project having gone sideways. Mm. I think in that they essentially funded a port, and when the Yemenis, who are, you know, literally starving, could not pay them back, they took it over. Took over, like, their major port?
It's one of their major ports. Wait, are you talking about Hodeidah? Do you know?
Yeah, in the north there.
Yeah. I mean, there's been lots of controversy there over just, you know, who controls it when and not letting in supplies. It's just a shit show, right? I mean, for a couple of years now. And I think China plays, like, the smallest role, though, in that, which is good.
But these soldiers seem to be pretty well taken care of on their aircraft carrier.
I mean, they got candy up there.
They do. They do. But,
the car bomb scene, like the VBID scene where,
We could also talk about the car bomb scene in reference to, like, the Hurt Locker, because they had a similar situation there, but in the Hurt Locker, they couldn't save the guy. And in this movie, they do.
And then the civilian was calling the PLA guy an American.
Yeah.
Yeah. For, like, I mean,
I can't tell if that's shade or not. I mean, there's, like, a few instances of things like that.
Because I know
it comes out of nowhere where at the end of the movie, there's, like a funeral for I don't know. There were, like, literally, like, 8 soldiers in this entire movie, and almost all of them died. But on the warship, they have, like, a little funeral. And then at the end of that, there's just this, like, 3 U.S. warships on the radar approaching, I guess, Chinese waters, and an announcer saying, you know, stop, you can't enter China. And the movie just cuts to black.
Wow.
Kind of like Wolf Warrior 2, right? At the end, that final, like, fight scene between Big Daddy and Wolf Warrior, and he's just like, well, Big Daddy was saying something like, I didn't know that the Chinese could fight, and he's like, oh. This is the new China.
Look forward to that upcoming episode.
Do we want to talk about the journalist?
I do want to talk about the journalist.
Yeah. She absolutely blew. Everything about that plot line sucked.
Yeah.
I mean, I think her assistant was worse, honestly.
Just in terms of acting.
Purely in terms of acting, I'm talking. The assistant, Abu, he was bad.
Yeah, it was a rough watch in terms of acting, kind of all around.
Yeah,
the journalist especially. It felt like she was a literal journalist who was like, "This is her break."
Oh,
I didn't. No, actually, I feel like some of the acting was solid. I feel like a lot of the acting from, like, the core cast was pretty okay.
Yeah, like, the battle scenes weren't bad. I mean, fighting an insurgency like that, at one point the jihadis, like, literally, you know, led them into the war zone, which was super brutal, but
yeah,
at that point
they blew up a building just in one quick bomb, like a huge car bomb. Wow. The,
like, legitimate government did absolutely nothing in this movie, like, no support, no air support. It's just the Chinese, man.
I'm also curious how
I thought it was interesting because they did sort of have that collectivist narrative that it's this squad that's doing everything, but it was also sort of a single protagonist narrative because this squad was acting entirely alone without any support.
Yeah.
You know? I just thought that was an interesting dynamic that was going, because they didn't get any help from the native government, they didn't get any help from their warship because they had their communications cut off at a certain point.
Well, the government asked basically the Chinese to save them, right? And that was really their role in it, like, come save us from the rebels that we can't defend ourselves against.
Yeah.
And yet they are very insistent that the person that they're going in to save is the Chinese citizen exclusively, until, you know, the journalist wields some sort of influence, which is either an interesting fiction or maybe reflective of reality, you know, making them take a more international stance.
I mean, reflective of reality, I think that the moment that journalist picked up a gun, she's dead. I think, like, somebody with no military training going into, like, the highest of high war zones.
Dude, she disguises herself in, like, a hijab and actually just enters the headquarters of ISIS. Badass. Yeah.
Oh, also, can we talk about that one? And you know, speaking of things that are like not in concert with reality, can we talk about that one bazooka missile just bumping up against a bunch of columns?
That was a cool shot, though. That was cool.
there were so many bullet tracking shots. I don't know. That was awesome. Yeah. Like the sniper shot that like goes through the window.
Oh, on the ship at the beginning.
Super slow motion.
Yeah, and then through that guy's head.
So dope. And then it hits a lamp. You think there's like one specialist in the film industry who just takes care of every bullet tracking shot?
I mean, for this movie, he would have had his work cut out for him if it's just one guy.
It's payday.
They keep that guy on retainer.
Yeah.
Honestly, dude, you should drop like your film studies and just learn how to track bullet shots and move to Beijing.
Move to Hong Kong.
You could easily get this job as the white man in China.
Oh, speaking of the armorer for this movie, actually, yep. Accepted my LinkedIn request.
You
and
connected.
I connected on LinkedIn with the armorer for this movie, and then I sent him a follow-up message being like, hey, would you want to come on the show? And he just sent me a thumbs up. I don't know what that means.
Dude, it's been like less than 6 months since like we even saw like from the idea of this project, and we've gotten impressively close to the PLA.
Yeah, not close enough.
Awesome.
But this armor, is he with the PLA or is he different?
No,
is
he's
he like
French.
Oh, okay. I guess maybe that's why they were using the EU arsenal, because it was all French weapons.
Just the EU as the region of the world that does nothing.
I mean, the EU is primarily like a military alliance. That's one of the main reasons for it existing.
Well, it's initially an economic
primarily
alliance.
Primarily a money alliance. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, well, now.
No. Initially.
Literal coal companies and steel companies.
Right, the Benelux countries. But this isn't interesting. Let's not talk about the economic structure of the EU.
Dude, yeah. I don't know. I love talking about how they screw, like, Greek over. It's awesome.
Famously, nothing about the EU is interesting.
Not true. Brussels is the best city in the world, dude.
God, no.
Bruges.
Bruges is nice.
I'd love to see a Chinese like in Bruges, but like in in Xinjiang or something.
I mean, to be honest, though, kind of Detective Chinatown, maybe.
No, because the whole point of New York City is like how boring Bruges is. New York,
yeah.
Like New York City is the tourist destination. The America.
It's the next step in the Chinese tourist movies. Bad vacations.
You guys want to talk about the energy guy who like has the what was it? Like the secret to destroying the world, and then just kind of gets his nipples torn off.
Yeah, he did, because they didn't show that. They didn't show that in the torture scene. They didn't show them doing anything to his nipples, but then when they found his body, they were just completely taken off.
I was hoping he'd have a bigger role, you know? Like, he's...
It seemed like he was going to.
But, well, I don't know. Can't fuck with ISIS. Can't make deals with ISIS.
This is not gonna mesh well with the interview we have ahead.
No, this is gonna be hilarious. That's why this show works. Juxtaposition is at the heart of our show.
Oh my god.
So weird, like that bit about the Venezuela. Like, yeah, dude, like I learned to be a sniper, like a Chavista sniper. It's like, fuck, dude, I wish I could have been in Venezuela.
Right. Yeah.
What the hell? This is made in 2017, dude. Like, this is not even good Venezuela. This is like the shit end of Venezuela.
It's true, yeah. Also, shit had gone bad like for a while there already. Like
if this was a 2007, yeah, you're like, fuck yeah, like, you know, there's oil money there and Chavez.
Yeah, but before Maduro, yeah. Anything before Maduro.
Dude, this is the lesson that you have to just get rid of all your capitalists. Chavez fucked up. Can't make deals with capitalists, can't make deals with ISIS. We should make one of these movies. You think we can get funding to do like a fake coup in, I don't know, Azerbaijan or something?
Yeah, dude, it'll be documentary style. It'll be like Borat.
Oh, I love Borat so much. That's still probably the best movie ever.
Yeah, like Sacha Baron Cohen makes a PLA movie. I would be into that.
Damn, if he did his like tactics in China, we'd probably never see him again.
No.
Probably not, yeah.
I mean, but
hey, we did see Fan Bing Bing again, so I guess.
True.
I think there's a difference between, like,
that happened, like, during our show, too, which is dope. Like, she was gone and came back.
But no, I think, like, you know, if the PLA were to fund Sacha Baron Cohen's next project.
Why are we treating this as even, like, somewhat possible?
Dude, anything is possible in the Belt and Road Initiative.
Yeah. I mean, it's a short leap from Iran Murad to, you know, from the Wolf Warrior.
General Iran Murad. Commander General Iran Murad.
Oh my god.
General. Every single episode he had a different rank.
Yeah, it was a solid show.
This movie was pretty, like, I was surprised by how dark this movie was. I don't know if I want to say dark, but I was surprised at how much
it was,
like,
bleak.
Death and destruction.
Whoever was in charge of makeup should not be allowed into the U.S. That man is a psychopath.
Whoever was in charge of makeup did a great job. It was
so nuts. Like, there was so many unnecessary shots of, like, just dismembered legs and faces. Like,
I mean, that's the DP's fault. That's not the makeup guy's fault.
I mean, I feel like it's a moral failing of the movie as a whole.
Too much, like, power to do this.
Seriously, though. I mean, I was expecting it to be more, like, look at how strong we are coming in here and fixing the situation. But no, it was like people took serious losses.
Because I've been trying to think of why Wolf Warrior succeeds. And this one, though it financially succeeded as a film, very much fails. And I think it's like a tonal issue, like Wolf Warrior, or it's an issue of like charm. I think Wolf Warrior can have all of these horrific, you know, dismemberments, stabbings, explosions, but on a basic level Wu Jing is charming. You know, it's like Clint Eastwood.
Well, Wu Jing
brutality,
kind of Wu Jing, like Wolf Warrior, kind of exists in the same setting, but like it's honed into, you know, the Wolf Warrior rather than the war zone, and I think that's effective.
But I guess
the public really likes the war zone, which is why this makes, like, you know, so much fucking money.
Well, this is a portrait, I think, exclusively of the war zone, you know? It, like, there's no human at the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah,
the main
character
is destruction.
Wolf Warrior, they got that single protagonist going, which is very Hollywood. And also, I think, makes you able to sympathize with it a lot more, because there's just this one person you're keeping track of, whereas in this movie, it's so many people, and they're all over the place.
Also, soundtrack. Wolf Warrior 2 had good music. This had really abhorrent music.
I didn't notice the music in this. It was such a slog to get through this one, and I say this about some of the movies we watch, but, like,
I like this movie.
That's because
I didn't hate it. I think, like, some of the military tech was kind of cool. I don't know, like, using...
I like the ads. It's like watching the Super Bowl. You're like... like
ads. I mean, what else do you watch this for? You watch for, like, the, you know, anti-missile weapons, the warships, the command structure. So sexy.
I do wonder, like, did they get an actual warship for this movie? I mean, I feel like they must have. Especially since the PLA Navy was listed in the credits.
Hmm.
I mean, it was. In the opening credits, yeah.
This one's a Hong Kong production, or at least it has, it's a lot of its funding is Hong Kong funding.
Huh.
It rules that Hong Kong is just, like, a little state now.
Well, it's interesting that it's, like, more aggressively... Like, these Hong Kong filmmakers, specifically Dante Lam and his crew, are just so... Like, this is the most advanced propaganda. And that it's coming out of Hong Kong is such a fascinating shift.
There was that awesome scene in the war zone where, like, everything is blown up and just, like, one tiny grenade blows up a building, but there's a super shiny Chinese, like, bank or something. Fucking awesome, dude. Their infrastructure is so good.
Yeah, look at those roads that certainly have not deteriorated really quickly.
I mean, as long as you could have gone to the port and the field, like, 10 times, it's probably good enough for the road. I mean, it pays
off. It's a free road. Why are you complaining? We're just going to take your lumber. It's fine.
Facts.
Shut up. What about that one kid, though? I don't know if he was a kid or not, but he was on the side of Zaka. He had, like, a blue hoodie. He's the one who got his ear shot off.
Oh, the ISIS intern?
Right? Yeah,
it seemed pretty badass for a long time.
But it was weird because I couldn't quite tell how old he was. And I, because the camera kept focusing on him, I was like, am I supposed to, like, I don't know, somehow feel connected to this character?
Yeah, it
and
felt like he was somebody you were supposed to sympathize with at some level.
At the end, he just quickly gets shot through a wall. One falls, he's dead.
He you looked like he was a kid.
Yeah, exactly.
I've seen him like Cersei. No, but yeah, I mean, he had a lot. His KD was good. Kill-death ratio was solid.
Oh, yeah, but he lost his ear.
Yeah, and then he died.
Right.
No, he was fine for the majority of the film with one ear. Kind of like Van Gogh, Isis Van Gogh.
Remember when he took that sheep head and used it as a mount for his rifle for the last shootout?
Fucking badass.
Did you see that? Yeah. So weird.
I don't understand how, like, this camera's perspective, it's so disconnected from, like, anyone in that group that it's just, like, really searching for someone to, like, latch onto, and it will just almost randomly latch onto. Obviously,
I feel like they hired, like, a ESPN, like, photographer or something. Like, the way they followed the action, just couldn't really figure out where to focus, and just, I don't know, it was disparate.
Interesting, like aesthetically, some of the action looked good. For instance, the like tank battle in the dust.
Oh yeah, that looked really good.
But it didn't seem to serve a purpose of any sort, except to be like, look at our weapons. But beyond that, to drive the story forward, I don't think it did anything.
I mean, well,
the moral of the story is Arabia can't be conquered by anybody.
The journalist got to fulfill that prophecy that was said earlier when he said, you have to do what I tell you to do by not doing what he told her to do.
Mm. Yeah, she asked, but what if the order is not right? And he's like, just follow it.
Remember that super dramatic scene where the journalist is in the bus with, like, the people from the consul, and she, like, gives somebody her inhaler? And there's, like, way too long. The camera takes way too long on this scene, and I don't know, do people like journalists? Or, like, is she supposed to be somebody we sympathize with? Because she really just is so boring.
Well, she's the whiskey Tango Foxtrot of this movie.
Yeah. A reference for, like, the few people who saw that fucking movie.
Yeah, for the five people that watched.
I was one of them, though.
I wasn't.
Yeah, but it's a good good trope.
No, but at the beginning, literally, the way that they portray her work is her assistant comes in and he's like, here's your target. That was amazing.
PLA journalist.
Right, like the understanding of what a journalist does.
Where was she based? Was that like Morocco or
something? Yeah, I think it was Morocco. But also, what happened to her boss?
He's also like a really well-known actor, Simon Lam. He's in the first Killzone movie, which is kind of one of the big things that launched Wu Jing. Mm. He's like the main guy in there.
The only thing that launched Wu Jing was his work ethic and incredible charisma.
Dude, he's got calves that make him jump so high.
They make him. They don't give him a choice.
Right, yeah, no, he's tired. But he's leaping to the top of Everest next in that Jackie Chan movie.
Oh, fuck yeah.
I'm so excited up there.
No, this is like a historical movie. You can't make a modern Everest movie.
Yeah. I mean, after the events of like a couple weeks ago, I think that you have pretty good grounds for making a modern Everest.
There was some good
art. Like a modern Everest comedy.
Those pictures were so funny.
No.
The sequel to Hello, Mr. Billionaire.
So if you guys were in this war zone, what role would you like? Would you like to be the woman? Would you like to be the sniper? Would you like to be
the man with the candy? I think I'd be the man with the candy. I'd lose my face, but I get to eat candy. Yeah, and I wouldn't feel pain. I wouldn't feel pain because of the candy.
No. Remember when he offered that other guy the candy because he'd been shot?
Remember when he's dying and she sticks the like hard candy in his mouth?
Yeah, I think he didn't want it at that point. I think not want to have candy shoved in his mouth as he
that was
died.
So, I think Christopher Nolan really fucked up when the Joker didn't offer Two-Face candy in the hospital.
just shove hard candy into his mouth.
Yeah.
Where is she?
I wonder how much candy he had in his pocket in any one moment, though. Because it seemed like he never worried about running out of it.
It's such like a Joe Pera old man thing to do. to constantly have hard candy on you. I'm just like picturing Joe Pera in his Chinese war zone.
I'd rewatch this movie if somebody put the time in to just have Joe Pera walking through the entire movie, just like
I would rewatch this movie if Joe Pera dubbed it for all of the characters. Thanks, cool. Noah.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Reza.
Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Reza.
Here's our interview with James Dorsey. China, it's been about 2 years since they established their first overseas military base in the world, but it was located in Djibouti in the Horn. What are your thoughts on them deciding to do this now, with America retreating a bit in the world stage?
Well, I think there it's not so much America retreating, frankly. What I do think it has to do with several aspects. One is that as the Chinese grow economically, as they expand in terms of what they do internationally, both in terms of investment, but also in terms of their dependence on commodities and raw materials imports, including energy, and as they have an ever-growing Chinese diaspora, and not sort of the old diaspora, in other words, people who have emigrated over generations, but contemporary people have gone overseas in search of opportunity. The Chinese have found that their traditional principles of foreign and defense policy no longer are valid. And if there has been any part of the world that's driven them basically throwing those principles out the window, it's been the Middle East and North Africa. One of those principles was that they never would have foreign military bases. Fact of the matter is that, you know, when in 2011, they had to evacuate 35,000 Chinese from Libya. Then later from Yemen and from Iraq, they realized that they're going to need some sort of infrastructure. Now, the choice of Djibouti is not that surprising. Djibouti is basically rent a base. Everybody and his mother has a military base there. So it's a sort of logical place to put it. It's also a logical place to put it because one, the Chinese were already part of the anti-piracy coalition, so they had vessels going in and out of there. Two, the Chinese had a scare in, I think, 2011, maybe 2012, when a Chinese vessel was fired upon with rockets in the Suez Canal by a jihadist group. So putting it at a strategic crossroads of vital waterways makes perfect sense.
I had a question about the jihadi role, at least that it shows up in the movie. I mean, this movie ended up being one of China's biggest movies ever. And, you know, like the biggest influence here is the role of the Islamist extremists. But it also seems like something that wouldn't particularly be of first priority to a big Chinese audience, but it did end up being really such a big movie. So I was wondering why you think this happened.
You've got to remember or realize that you have growing Islamophobia in China. And on top of that, you have a Chinese obsession with, you know, their definition of terrorism, which is very broad-ranging and is everything from religious extremism to separatism. And that's why, you, among other reasons, why you see this brutal crackdown on Turkic Muslims in the northwestern province of Xinjiang and an absolute obsession with any form of expression of ethnic identity. So the fact that the jihadist aspect of this would appeal to a Chinese audience is not that surprising.
How would you describe or compare American Islamophobia as it is today with Chinese Islamophobia? And I'm just wondering if there's any state-sanctioned aspect to Chinese Islamophobia, or if it's entirely...
Well, no, there's the as I understand it, in Xinjiang, it's an entire Islamophobic system.
I cannot think of any example of a frontal assault on Islam and an attempt not to rewrite the surahs of the Quran, but to essentially rewrite what Islam means and what its role is. There's been nothing like what is happening in Xinjiang, you know, where you have, according to estimates, 1 million people, if not more, in re-education camps where they are taught to violate Islamic religious laws and taught that Xi Jinping thought supersedes Islam. You've seen nothing like that anywhere in the world, whether the West or elsewhere. And that is the state doing it.
And is that entirely in reaction to Islamic organizing in the world or Islamic-related terrorism in the world in recent years? Or are there other internal factors driving that?
I think there are a number of factors. First of all, Xinjiang, you cannot underestimate the importance of Xinjiang to China. Of the 147 minerals and raw materials that China has, 115 of those are located in Xinjiang. Xinjiang is where China has its nuclear arsenal. And Xinjiang borders on 8 countries and is a core pillar of the Belt and Road Initiative. So, you know, the importance of Xinjiang cannot be underrated. The crackdown is the sharp end or the most extreme example of what is, on the one hand, a broader crackdown on religion. Just look at what's happening to Christian churches and the number of Christians that have been detained. And it goes back to a proposal that was made by 2 very prominent Chinese scholars, one of whom now is a very senior official in Xinjiang, who back in 2011 called into question China's longstanding policy of basically, for all practical purposes, recognizing the minority rights of the 56 nationalities that they recognize as resident in China. And the proposal was to revoke that policy and to basically homogenize the population. So what's happening in Xinjiang, which is homogenization for all practical purposes, is sort of the, in any case, certainly the first step, if not the most extreme example. It's also, to me, the testing ground for a 21st century Orwellian surveillance state.
Mm. What's your take on Uyghurs in Xinjiang going over to Syria to fight? I mean, there's lots of articles, I think, that come out periodically about perhaps China taking a role militarily in Syria to tackle this issue, but it also doesn't seem to actually materialize ever.
Well, look, there are an X number of Uyghurs, and the numbers range anywhere from the hundreds to up to 5,000 who went to Syria. It's not all that surprising as such. The Uyghurs have proven themselves to be among the best fighters that the Islamic State and other groups, which had Uyghurs among as their members, Uyghurs proved to be among their best fighters. And so, yes, that's a legitimate concern. The problem with it is that they're not going to resolve this problem in the way that they're handling it in Xinjiang. If anything, they're probably going to exacerbate it. There was at one point some discussion last year, some discussion in the Chinese media and elsewhere, that the Chinese may want to contribute to an assault on Idlib, the northern Syrian province, which is the only one that's still held by Syrian rebels. But that they've sort of backed away from at this point. Essentially, they've got the Russians and the Syrian government doing the dirty work.
Could we talk about the role of the media in this movie? Because it seems that the way that it functions in this media, a reporter essentially gets co-opted into the command structure of the PLA. Have there been any examples of that in a sort of less direct way happening in Chinese media abroad outside of China?
Look, I don't think it's a question of getting co-opted by the PLA. Xi Jinping has made it very clear last year, the Chinese media's role is to propagate Xi Jinping thought and the Chinese Communist Party's policy. That's what their role is. And you're seeing that crackdown increasingly, not only among, you know, so first you don't have a critical press of any kind left in China. And you're seeing the same happening in academia. I mean, I listened to a Chinese academic yesterday speaking, and, you know, I could have read it on Xinhua.
Is there a large structure of foreign bureaus for Chinese media?
You had a report a couple of months ago by Reporters Without Borders, which was entitled China's New Media World Order. The Chinese have essentially bought up the vast majority of diaspora Chinese publications.
Oh, wow.
There are very few independent diaspora Chinese publications today. In various places, they have bought stakes in media. In South Africa, for example, where last year a longstanding columnist of a newspaper was, a column of his was not published, and ultimately, whether he was fired or left the paper, I don't recall now. But in any case, he no longer is with the paper because the Chinese objected to a column of his that, if I recall correctly, was about Xinjiang.
Wow.
The Chinese are also expanding exponentially the foreign presence of their state-run TV network. And Chinese diplomats are instructed to be far more aggressive, and in some cases are also commended for being undiplomatic. For example, objecting to reporting on independent media outside of the country. You've had incidents recently in Sweden, for example.
Could you talk a bit about investments in the region and what role the military plays in what comes first, the investments protecting them with the military or the projection thereafter?
Look, let's be clear. The Chinese military has not projected much internationally. They've been very, very present and very active in United Nations peacekeeping, and often have proven to be very good peacekeepers. Obviously, you have the base in Djibouti, and you have some form of military presence on the Tajik and Afghan sides of the border with China, and that is primarily at making sure that nobody illicitly crosses the border. And that has a lot to do with concern of Uyghur fighters who were in Syria migrating to Central Asia, South and Central Asia. Normally, you know, routinely the pattern is that Chinese companies, often Chinese state-owned companies, do overseas investments. And rather than the PLA projecting itself, you've seen the flourishing of a Chinese private security industry. You know, you see private Chinese security often overseas.
In this film, there's because you mentioned the cohesiveness of the private security sector with the militaries of the rest of the world. In this film, the Chinese Navy uses defensive weapons from the EU. That's how they describe it, that they receive military support from the European Union to assist them in this specific mission. Is that sort of military cooperation within the realm of the Middle East typical for China, or is it closer to their media outlook where it's really more down to handling this on its own?
Well, one, the Middle East is an important arms export market, and the Chinese increasingly are exporting, particularly items that the Americans or the Europeans have been unwilling to export. So you've seen, I think 2 years ago, the establishment of a drone manufacturing facility in Saudi Arabia. You had in January, and now confirmed by U.S. officials in a CNN report this week, but you had in January the publication of satellite pictures that showed the Chinese building a ballistic missiles production site in Saudi Arabia. So arms exports has become very, you know, is increasingly becoming important. You're seeing a fair number of port visits by Chinese vessels in the Middle East. And you've seen some joint exercises And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw more of that kind of thing as we move forward.
There's an extensive use of drones in this movie, and that, I found that particularly interesting because it's kind of the tactics, I guess, you see in modern wars, you know, in Yemen, you see this in Syria, but there isn't too much representation of this in, like, Hollywood film, but China does use a lot of drone footage in their movies. I was wondering if you could go into that a little bit, how they use more modern techniques in urban warfare.
If I recall, there was a couple of years ago a Hollywood movie on the use of drones, actually. But, you know, sure, drone warfare is becoming mainstream, if not a norm. And the Americans who produce the world's best killer drone are very limited in their willingness to export those drones. Some of America's closest allies, including Saudi Arabia, have been rejected in their effort to buy American drones. The next best thing is a Chinese drone, and the Chinese have capitalized on that. Their drone sales have gone through the roof. So the fact that the Chinese would be emphasizing their drones in a movie like this makes perfect sense.
Do you think a movie like this has like a sort of advertising function as well?
Of course it does. Yeah, look, but so do Hollywood movies, you know, by design or by default. Obviously, it movies shape images and perceptions of people.
There was one part where the sniper talks about his elite sniper training that he undertook in Venezuela. I wanted to ask about maybe other countries, other places that the Chinese train with and how that comes to fruition.
Well, frankly, I'm not sure how much training they've done in Venezuela. So I would take that part of it with a grain of salt. Look, the Chinese have, you know, they don't need all that much foreign training. They also have, of course, an alliance with people like Eric Prince, the former owner of Blackwater. So I'm sure that you have Chinese-trained, extremely skilled Chinese snipers.
The presence of mercenaries, as Eric Prince's Blackwater was, is a really noticeable part as the sort of ubiquitous enemy in most Chinese war-related films.
I'm not sure that, you know, Eric Prince's operations in China, including in Xinjiang, involve mercenaries. So he's providing a service, he's providing training and what have you, but it's of Chinese nationals.
Ah, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, and the Chinese private security companies, to the best of my knowledge, are largely populated by Chinese nationals. Now, they may have locals on the ground in places like Kazakhstan or elsewhere in Central Asia, but it's not like you have mercenaries based in China.
In these films, it's foreign mercenaries that are often portrayed as the enemy. And is that because that's one of the larger security operations that they're sort of competing against in Africa? I think essentially that in a lot of these movies, the enemy, instead of being, as in some American movies of the 80s, a foreign country or even an Islamic organization, or even in like an ideological organization, the enemy is a sort of non-ideological, money-driven mercenaries in most of these films? And does that reflect any of the...
Look, China's battles on whatever level, political, economic, military, whatever, are not ideological battles. You know, China may call itself a communist state, but it's, you know, it's basically a totalitarian capitalist state. There's no ideology involved here. But having said that, it is competing for control and for influence in what is going to be a new world order. And in that sense, you know, the Chinese are willing to identify Islamists as an enemy, but they're not going to go out and define the United States at this point as an enemy. But obviously, the United States is not a friend.
So this movie was released on the 90th anniversary of the PLA. I wanted to ask about like the general public, their thoughts or how they feel about the military. maybe compared with, we can talk about a little bit how we see it in the U.S.
Well, first of all, you know, there is no independent polling of how what Chinese think. But fact of the matter is that part of what has shaped China in recent years is a very nationalist Chinese attitude that is popular among the Chinese public. Some people have called it hyper-nationalism. So China's very assertive positions, and you saw that recently in a major security conference here in Singapore last week. China's very assertive about those things, whether it's place in the world, whether the kind of respect, some people would call it kowtowing, that the Chinese expect, Taiwan, territorial claims to the South China Sea, just go down the line.
Could you talk a bit about the Belt and Road Initiative? I feel like this is something that gets a ton of media noise and with very little proper definition. I think we're pretty guilty of that too. What's the main purpose of this moving forward?
I think it's basically, you know, it comes out of two things. The Chinese had overcapacity and they needed to export. So in terms of construction and what have you, so as not to suffer domestic economic consequences. There is debate about whether or not this is also a geopolitical ploy. I would argue that even if it was not conceived as a geopolitical ploy, the scale on which it's been rolled out, even if it may be smaller than all the figures that are being bandied around, by definition would become a geopolitical ploy. There was no other way than doing it. It hasn't quite worked out the way the Chinese had envisioned, simply because Chinese terms and the way it's implemented in practice has created a lot of domestic anti-Chinese sentiment in various countries, you know, in terms of the financial terms of the funding, in terms of the insistence on relying on Chinese labor and Chinese materials. Basically, for a lot of these infrastructure projects, the projects themselves, by and large, may very well be useful to the countries involved, but maybe not necessarily on those terms. And the project itself, in terms of its development, doesn't necessarily benefit local economies. And so the Chinese are encountering significant resistance in multiple places.
So the terrorists in this movie are acquiring what seems like nuclear material from a private contractor. Can we ask a little bit about China's nuclear program? I've never really heard too much about this.
Look, China's a nuclear power. You know, alongside the United States and Pakistan and India and the European powers, they're a nuclear power. Basically, you know, they've been helpful in nuclear programs, not necessarily nuclear weapons programs, although I certainly wouldn't exclude that, certainly not in the case of Pakistan. But, you know, the Iranian nuclear program started with Chinese support. Now, that was for peaceful purposes. In the Pakistani case, it was different. I mean, I think there's some question of whether the Chinese in the past did not have a hand in North Korea. What you are seeing is now, and that's certainly the case with Saudi Arabia, where the Chinese conditions and controls on export of technology, again, not technology that explicitly and directly would serve development of nuclear weapons, but for peaceful purposes, Chinese controls and limits are far lower than those of the United States. So you have the whole issue at the moment. And you saw recently that the United States has circumvented Congress in supplying all kinds of technologies to the Saudis without informing Congress because of these controls. And there's been a lot of debate in the United States on whether or not they were going to disadvantage Westinghouse by imposing what's called the gold standard, which really is designed to ensure that peaceful nuclear technology cannot be diverted to develop a nuclear capability.
I think it's about time we close this chapter of Uproar in the Studio. Thank you again to James Dorsey.
Original music comes from Elliot Saltmarsh and Yehuda of Fist with a PH, and our art comes courtesy of Jay Castro.
Follow us on Twitter at China Film Pod, like the Uproar in the Studio Facebook page, and maybe Venmo us at Reza-Saeed, and put Uproar in your description. All proceeds for this episode will go towards buying the entire line of Operation Red Sea-inspired toys, literal tanks, help out, and if you feel like it, have some thoughts or suggestions, email us at uproarinthestudio, all in one word, at gmail.com.
In 2 weeks, we'll be talking about Wandering Earth, but before we leave you this week, we just want to share some wisdom from the chairman.
To read too many books is harmful. We will see you in 2 weeks.